Today is Sunday, May 22nd, 2022. This is part 31 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview series with Jim Haggart. Jim spells his last name H-A-G-G-A-R-T. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Jim. How are you today?
Doing great today, Tom. How are you?
Very good. Thank you for asking. I'm glad to hear you're doing well. As with all these oral histories, Jim, may we have your permission to record this over the telephone?
Yes, go right ahead.
Thank you. We left off last time in 2014. Do you want to take us into 2015?
Sure, yeah. So 2015, I started to prepare for a spring trip as typical. It's the best time, I think, to hike in the canyon, and this trip was another trip with Art. And it was another, as I typically say at the beginning of these descriptions, it was another ambitious hike with a significant plan. So this was to go back into Nankwe, because we had some nagging summits that we hadn't climbed yet, Art and I, and that were fairly easy, right? They're third classers, right? So we wanted to nab these. And these included Hubble, which we'd tried. We got right up to the summit block a few years prior, but were just exhausted and gave that up. And then also Juno and Jupiter. And so the plan was that we would that we would go down into Nankweep and then work our way over into Quaggint and then from there go over Cochise Butte and then come up to Hubble from below. So we would climb the Red Wall just east of Cochise Butte,
okay,
and then drop down into Char Valley, and then we could work up to Hubble Butte, and there's a big unnamed massif that's about a kilometer east of Hubble that I've always been fascinated with. It looks like it's an easy climb, but it's just a massive Red Wall massif that stands out alone. Quite a break from the the rim ridge, and that's basically southeast of Butcher Butte. So, anyways, the idea was to potentially try and knock off a number of these summits that are fairly easy to get if you're in the area and you're feeling good, right?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So on the 15th of April, I flew down, and Art picked me up at the airport. And one thing that I have to say, hiking with Art is a wonderful experience, and we just clicked on so many levels. And one of the things that he did on this trip was he prepared all the food that we ate.
Oh wow!
And which is a real boon for me because I was super busy before the trip here in town doing my work, dehydrating food and then preparing it for traveling and carrying is a time-consuming task, and Art did all this. He always does it for himself, of course, and this time he offered to do it for me, and so it was a real pleasure to have him do that. I want to point that out and acknowledge that because I really appreciate the efforts that he went through on that. And so anyways, he had all this food handy, which was really good because it saved us a lot of time. Typically when I fly down there, I've got to buy things like beef jerky, which you can't bring across the border, and other miscellaneous things, and typically a stop at REI if Art hasn't already done that on my behalf, etc. So we were able to save a fair amount of time then, after visiting with my mother, we then headed up to Flagstaff, and then from there we headed on to Vermilion Cliffs where we had dinner, and this is just around the time. Well, this is right after the fire of Marble Canyon Lodge, right? So we were able to look into that. Well, they have a temporary cafe there, and at this time we were looking into what. They were starting to do with renovating the old cafe.
Right.
And it looked kind of grim in there and stark. So anyways, it was closed, and so we went on to Vermilion Cliffs and had a great dinner there, and then went back to Marble Canyon Lodge to get a room for the night. So, I think in the last couple of trips, I've mentioned that this business of getting a room is starting to work into our into our trips. You know, it's always nice to. It always used to be nice to get it. I mean, it was initially we would just head on home from the trip after at the end of a trip and get into Flagstaff at or Phoenix at 12 or 2 in the morning or something like that. And so then it was very easy to justify getting a hotel room at the end of the trip, right? Got to clean up and all that. But now here we are getting a hotel room at the beginning of the trip. So it's evolution, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but anyways, you do feel fresh, I have to say. And so in the morning we got up at first light and left Marble Canyon and headed for House Rock Valley to the Saddle Mountain Trailhead. And when we got on the trail, it went really quickly this time. It was only an hour and a half. I think the last time we'd been in there was like 2 hours it took us to get up to the saddle. Oh. This time it was only 90 minutes, and maybe that we didn't have any climbing gear this time. Like last time we had about 4 or 5 pounds of climbing gear each, so, you know, that adds up. And in fact, we kind of calculated that our packs were under 30 pounds for a 9-day trip. So,
wow.
And that included some water. So, and in fact, when we got to the trail, to the saddle there, we encountered a couple, young couple in their 20s, late 20s, I would guess. And they had just spent some 3 or 4 days down in Nankweep, and they said they had a wonderful time, but had to change their plans because they vastly over-anticipated what they could do. You know, the size of the place is so huge, and it's so challenging to get around. And so, but I remember looking at their packs and thinking that, you know, these huge backpacks with all this stuff hanging off the sides, and you know, and here we are heading out for 9 days with these little compact things. And so, but anyways, when you're old, you know, you got to come up with ways to get around.
That's right.
To get around the lack of physical capacity. So yeah, we headed down the Nankweep Trail then, you know, and the trail, of course, nowadays is very, 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 very clear. So there's always new. You do see new boulders that have fallen into it, you know, after a winter rain or a storm season. There's always the little things, little washouts here and there, but then the hikers quickly, work that out and cover it up. And so, you know, you can make good time on this trail now. And we got down to the red wall and dropped below that. And just if you're coming down the trail and you get through the red wall, at the bottom, which is basically a big long slide, and at the bottom of that, there's a traverse along some Bright Angel shale ledges for about a half a mile to the east. And just before you start that traverse, there's a big slide block of red wall limestone that has dropped down and formed this big hill just south of this cliff of Bright Angel Shale that you can traverse, that the trail traverses along. And so we thought, well, let's take a shortcut to get into Nankweep, and we'll go down this slide block. And I had done this in 15 years before when Art and Bruce and I were in Nankweep, and I did Barbancita in a day trip or an afternoon trip.
Okay.
And I came back down and basically, instead of following the Nankweep along this horizontal traverse, the Nankweep Trail, just dropped down to this big red wall slide and worked my way down there. And it's a little steep at the top. You know, it's very very loose because you're having to work your way down this cliff of the BA Shale. And then you get onto this very narrow talus ridge that connects you with this big red wall slide hill. And then from there, it's fairly straightforward going. And there's deer trails. It's not like this is challenge. You know, it's not like this is exploration or anything. It's pretty obvious. But you do have to keep your wits together because it's quite exposed and steep and loose. And so we started down that, and it's actually slower going than I had remembered. And in fact, down on the slope, like 2/3 of the way down to the drainage of Nankweep Creek below. Mm-hmm. So this is going down into the drainage that's between Marion Point and Tilted Mesa.
Okay.
And we got down close to the drainage, and Art took a spill on this steep talus, and he went right down onto a prickly pear. It was pretty gnarly, you know. And so we spent some time there, and it was pretty frustrating because, you know, we had taken this shortcut supposedly to save time, and it was obvious that even without the fall into the prickly pear, you know, there was no real time savings to be had. Mm. So I think, because our objective was to get down to the bed of Nanquy close to where the main trail comes down anyways, right? If you were going into Upper Nanquy, then this shortcut might make a little sense. Mm. But on the other hand, you might as well just come down the route between Sieber Point and Marion Point just below the saddle, right? So, but, you know, it's exploration, and Art had never done that route before, so, you know, he was happy to give it a shot. So, anyways, we worked our way down to the bed of the creek, Nanquip Creek, and rested there for a little while. And there was a fellow. There were some people camped down below at the standard campsite there, where the trail meets the creek. And we chatted with a guy who had hiked upstream for a ways and was coming back. So, this was like 3 in the afternoon. So we made pretty good time going down. But we packed up our gear and our packs, and we hadn't taken anything apart. But we filled up with some water, and we headed up the beautiful little hike that I talked about last time, which goes up the drainage that's between, well, it's just west of Nanquy Butte.
Right.
And it's a very, very easy hike and walk. Because it's very low angle, and it's all just these shale chips. And it's very, straightforward walking. And when you get high up in this drainage, like as you're approaching the pass that's south of Nanquy Butte, it gets steep, and it's kind of hard to get your footing, you know, because it's like you step up 2.5 feet and you slide back 1.5 feet, right? But, you know, it's still fairly straightforward because it's all open. There's very little vegetation. And it's fabulous views. I think I said last time on the last trip description that saddle there south of Nanquy Butte is one of my favorite places in the Grand Canyon because you have this tremendous vista of all these peaks and drainages in front of you, you know, going up to the rim country, and it's just a magnificent view, and so a really neat place to be. So we passed through the butte, and then passed through the pass south of the butte, and then worked our way down the slopes there to the southeast to get into the drainage of Quaggan Creek.
Okay.
And by this time it was getting fairly late in the day, so we walked upstream to the spring that's east of Hutton Butte there, and camp for the night. So the next day, I mean, at this point we were feeling really good because, you know, the previous trip we'd taken the whole day to go from the Saddle Mountain Trailhead parking to get to the bed of Nanquip.
Right.
And this trip we'd gotten all the way over to Quaggan, you know, which is more like a productive hiking trip. So, you know, we were feeling really, really positive about that. And so the plan for the next day was to head then up over the ridge east of Cochise Butte, and then to drop down into Char Creek and the Char Valley there. And then we would do some climbing, as I mentioned, of summits. So we had some rain in the evening, but we had early evening, but we had our tarp, the Art Light tarp, and we were under that and perfectly content, right? So I told my wife a couple weeks ago, we were listening to the rain outside our bedroom, and you know, listen, just hearing it fall on the patio deck, and I'm thinking, I said to her, you know, I don't think there's any nicer sound than being in a nice warm sleeping bag and hearing a gentle rain on a tarp like 4 inches above your head, you know. It's just so peaceful and relaxing, and I don't think Renee necessarily sees it that way, but it's a really, I've had that experience so much in my life, and it's really you know, hit home. I really appreciate that experience, so. So, yeah, the next morning we got up. Of course, you know, it, as usual, as typical, it quite often will clear up in the morning. You have an overnight rain. And so we started up, and the idea now was to head up up the drainage that goes up to east of Cochise Butte. Now, in the last session we talked about, I mentioned the debris flow that we had found.
Yes.
And so this drainage that we're going to go up with our backpacks to try and cross over east of Cochise is the drainage of that debris flow. So it was kind of doubly exciting to go up this because, you know, we could see directly all the evidence of the debris flow. And it was very impressive, Tom. I mean, I don't study landslides, and so I don't see this kind of geology all the time. But
right.
There are places in this drainage where you can see that the debris torrent was like 12 or 15 meters high, deep.
Wow.
You know, because you can see stuff, debris up on boulders, right? That are on the edge of the drainage. And you can see where the debris torrent would split into parallel flows, with leaving a little island in between.
Oh, wow.
There are places where you can see, like, it was coming down and there was a turn in the drainage, right?
Right.
Pre-existing drainage.
Right.
And the debris flow rode up over, because of its velocity, it rode up over the wall of the drainage. And then spill down onto the grassy talus on the side of the drainage. It's just really spectacular.
Cool.
All this.
So that's on the outside edge of the curve.
Yes, the outside edge of the curve.
Super
exactly.
Elevation, I think, where the material just by momentum it just sloshes on up on the side, kind of like a race car going around a tight curve where it goes way up the side and then drops back down again.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay.
Great analogy. And you know, there were huge boulders that moved in this thing.
Wow.
You know, some like 8-10 meters in diameter,
right,
that were moved down this. And
wow.
It was just really fascinating from a geological point of view to see this. And I took hundreds of pictures.
Wow.
And thank God for digital. And I've always meant to write it up, and I've actually got some notes that I put together, a detailed outline, but
fun.
But I need to finish that off, because it's pretty cool, you know, to see it, and so, anyways, it was pretty fascinating to hike up this drainage and see all this geology, and of course we're looking up ahead of us where we have to go, we could see that we'd have to climb out of the drainage onto a steep talus cone. And that talus cone basically went up through most of the Tapetes cliff there.
Okay.
And from there, eventually we would get through the Tapetes through some scrambling. And then from there we had to contour to the west to get to this notch that's east of Cochise. Now, we had seen this notch many times from down below in our traversing in Quaggan Creek. You know, we're looking up and think, we always would think, is that a way to get across? And
right.
It looks so good, right? So we were very, we'd planned our whole trip around this notch, basically, because that was the way we were going to get into Char Creek,
and,
right?
And just to be clear, you hadn't gone through this notch before.
Oh, no. And we hadn't talked to anybody who had.
Okay.
So it was just based on our own, you know, reconnoitering.
Uh-huh.
And,
yeah, you bet.
But we felt pretty confident about it, right? So we started up. We left the drainage. We headed up the talus cone to get through the Tapetes, and then this very steep traverse through the shale, and there was even snow in there, right? The night before, it rained where we were down in the bed of Quaggan, but it snowed up at this elevation. So, but we worked our way through all this steep, slippery, wet slope and got up to the notch in the red wall. And there's an 8-foot overhang.
Oh wow!
And we just like could not believe it, you know. And we're looking at it and. And we could see that there were, like, if you could jump up to the lip of the overhang. You know, there were good holds there, and then you could do a pull-up, right, if you were so inclined. You could, and potentially climb up and get over this thing, but neither of us was in any condition to do this, and you know, it was pretty terminal, right, from a hiking point of view.
Wow.
So it was like, oh my goodness, you know, here we, the best laid plans, we thought we had it all worked out, and yet again, here we have to, you know, revise the trip in mid stride, and so, but you know, on the other hand, we got to see that debris flow geology. Mm-hmm. That was spectacular, you know, and so we had to reverse our steps and go back down to the bed of Quaggan. Well, we went down there. When we went down, we split up for just a little while, just as we re-entered the debris flow bed, because I wanted to go up a different arm and see if I could see more directly into the where the actual debris flow had fallen off the red wall.
So, right.
Yeah, this material had basically collapsed off the red wall.
Wow.
And you could see that from the debris chutes, right, going up to the base of the red wall cliff.
Okay.
So, yeah, so it was kind of neat to confirm that, and I came back down and rejoined Art, and we went back down to the valley of Quaggan. So we figured, well, you know, we're here, we got to have let's make a go of it, right? And so we went back down to our campsite and spent another night there, and the idea then was to go into Upper Quaggan and do some more exploring up there.
Okay.
There really wasn't much in the way of climbing that we hadn't done there. The only climb that we hadn't done was Hutton, and we knew that was a technical peak that was beyond our capabilities, and Jeffords Point too, which we hadn't done yet either. So, and anyways, we figured, well, it'll be fun to spend some time, more time in Quaggan. We'd just been in there 6 months before.
Right.
And we thought, well, we'll give it that shot. We'll give that red wall route another try, because we had gotten up the very end of the west arm of Quaggan on that last trip, but we're like, you know, a couple hundred feet below the top, and it looked like it could go, but we didn't have the time to push it through. So we thought we'd give it a shot this time. And the next day, we headed up and brought our gear up to the drainage that comes down from between Etoko and Banta Point. And that's the standard high route drainage that one takes when one is following the high route from Nankoweap over to Vishnu. It takes you up all the way up through the red wall, through the Supai, and then you can drop down into Char to the south. So we went to that drainage, and of course there's that water in there as well, and so that was nice to confirm that water was there and would be able to support us for the next day or two, because there's no definitive water in the upper part of Quaggan. It's seasonal, and of course we were there at the right season, but you never want to count on it, right? And so it's nice to know about this water pocket that exists in the Tapeets at the bottom of this drainage, so that I've always found water there, and I would pretty much recommend it through the hot season. So we dropped our gear there and found a nice place where we camped that night, and then we went up. Well, this was we went a little bit upstream to drop our gear from where that drainage comes down, and then found a nice campsite there, and then decided to day hike up into the upper drainages here. So the first one we went up is the drainage that is, it comes down directly east of Etoko. So it's one closer to Etoko Point than the drainage that I just referred to. So it's the next drainage to the west.
Okay.
And I mentioned this in our last hike because Art had looked up into this drainage when the two of us hiked up into Upper Quaggan. He had looked up in this drainage and thought it might go and through the red wall. So we thought, well, let's give it a go this trip. We've got the time. Let's take a look. So we did. We headed up this drainage, and really, nice, typical North Rim Nanquip red wall climb. Just gorgeous vegetation, and but eventually we reached a point where the chalk stones were just kind of unnegotiable, and we just couldn't get through. So
you would be in these small little kind of chimney sort of climbs, these little drainages, and you would go up, and there would be a chalk stone in the drainage. You couldn't get around.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, exactly. And you know, you poke around, you look around, you try and climb behind these chalk stones. I mean, sometimes you can find little passageways, behind a chalk stone, and do some little caving trip and pull yourself through. And I mean, one time out in 140 Mile Canyon, we actually excavated a little chimney or hole.
Uh-huh.
Climb through hole behind a chalk stone, so that helped us out quite a bit in that particular case. But in this drainage, we couldn't find anything. So we backtracked. We weren't counting on finding this. This was just a day trip, a day hike. I had mentioned the last trip in the description of the last trip that when we came down from our attempt to get up the west end of Quaggan. And we saw this particular drainage, I thought, oh, that would make a nice day hike from Atoko Point, to just drop down from the rim all the way down into Quaggan at the west end of Quaggan, and then come up this little drainage that's just directly east of Atoko Point. And, you know, it would make a nice hike, except that we couldn't find an easy way to do it, right? So anyways, We headed back down to the main bed of Quaggan, and to where we'd stashed our camping gear, and set up our camp there, and just relaxed for the rest of the day. And then, again, we had these great dinners that Art had produced. You know, what he does is he takes, he takes these Mountain House freeze-dried dinners. And I was never a big fan of these when I was young. I don't know why, because they're really good. And not only Mountain House. There's a couple of other brands as well. But he'll take two of these and rehydrate them.
Mm-hmm.
And then he splits that pile into three. And that makes three meals. So he gets three meals out of two.
Oh.
Packages, right? So it makes your your purchase go a little bit farther.
Yeah.
And also, quite honestly, you know, as a 60 some odd year old, I can't eat that much food anymore.
Right.
You know, and so and there's always something left. And if I'm eating a whole package, right? Of course, these packages are supposed to be for two, and of course, you know, there's no way you can feed two people on them. But anyways, it's. Art's got it all down to a science, right? And he had prepared all these meals out split the original components up into smaller packages, and then re-freeze dried them. Not technically freeze drying them, but he sucks all the air out of them. He dehydrates them and sucks all the air out of them. And maybe that is freeze drying. I don't know, but it makes it like it's just a package that you pulled off the shelf. And then you rehydrate it and you have the dinner. So fortunately we had these meals the entire trip, and it was just like luxury. I really, really appreciated him putting that together. So, and then another thing he does is he takes, he puts together breakfast and we'll take oatmeal and throw in some, instant oatmeal.
Uh-huh.
and then put in, some dairy cream or something like that, not dry cream,
right?
Milk powder, and then some brown sugar, and then freeze-dried fruit, right? And this is great on even on a summer morning or, you know, spring morning when it's
right.
not that cold.
Yeah.
It's great in the winter to have a meal like that, but it's really great in the spring as well. Anyways, again, I'm rapsing on about food here, so it's you can see it's one of the important parts of a Grand Canyon hike, right?
Mm.
As a river runner, I know you know that better than
uh-huh.
anybody else, right?
Yep.
So anyways, the next we camped spent the night here in Upper Nanqueep, and so the next day we wanted to go back up and try to get through the red wall that we had attempted 6 months prior. We'd gotten up pretty high, but ran out of time and couldn't finish it. So this time we did push it up higher. We pushed the route up higher by climbing, really nice, interesting red wall face climbs, and partly in trees, to get up through. You climb part of a tree to get up past an impassable lower part of a cliff, and then step across to the cliff. And it was very intricate back and forth, but we never made it. We just couldn't find.
Wow.
Eventually, we got to a point where, we were in 50 feet at the top of the red wall, very, very close. And again, we poked around looking for options, and the story is that Jim Ullman made it down through here. So, I'm sure that there's a route somewhere, but we just couldn't find it.
Okay.
I guess Jim's a better third classer than Art or I, at least on certain days. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
We turned back around and then headed back down the drainage, and then I tried to go up the next little drainage to the west from that because it had looked promising from below, but so Art stayed below in the main bed while I scrambled up for that, but I didn't get very far, and I realized it wasn't going to go. So we turned around and headed back down to our camp then in upper Quaggan, and we tried to get through the red wall here in three places, and I have to say that even though we didn't make it, it was still just such a rewarding experience, right? Because the exploration in each of these drainages was so exhilarating, it just really, there was no reason to feel disappointed, in the trip. And, of course, the trip's not over yet. We're
right.
still halfway through it, right? But my point is that we had, tried to make this passage through the red wall three different places and couldn't make it, but that's just part of the learning experience, right?
Right?
Part
and,
of the
and the standard routes are two to get from Quaggan south. One is along the Butte Fault, and the other is along the river.
To get from Quaggan south?
Yeah.
Well, you can take this high route.
You can, okay.
Yeah, okay, which I described earlier. So that goes between Etoko Point and Siegfried Pyre.
Okay.
And so that makes a third route.
Got it.
And it, because of the climbing involved, I mean, first of all, you have to be up high up in the drainage of Quaggan, right?
Right.
And then because of the elevation gain and climbing, it's a grunt to get up that climb.
Mm.
I have to tell you, out of Quaggan up to the saddle, it's like, 3,000 feet, and
wow.
It's really steep at the top and at altitude too. So, at least for a person like me.
Right.
So, it I'm not saying you shouldn't do it, but it's a lot of work.
Right.
And if you're not anywhere near that area, it's not worth your while to check that out.
Right.
Only if you want to get from Nanqueep into the upper part of Nanqueep and the upper part of Quaggan into the upper parts of Lava and Unkar that
right.
you take these high route passes. So,
right.
but
okay.
Anyways, so we decided to head back down and again rather than taking the high route pass into Nanqueep, we went back down to the route we'd come across a few days prior, just west of Nanqueep Butte, and we walked down the valley there of Quaggan, found that route again, went up the pass south of Nanqueep Butte and back down to Nanqueep Creek, and again we could see campers downstream at the bottom of the trail, so we hiked upstream a little ways to be away from the crowds And the next day, we decided what we wanted to do was to explore the southwest arm of Nanquib, because neither of us had ever been up this arm very far. I don't think either of us had been up past the junction with the arm that comes down from the Kibby Butte route,
okay,
which is basically kind of like the west arm of Nanquib, and it goes up. So that west arm of Nanquib goes up and heads between Kibby Butte and Hancock Butte and Mount Hayden. The southwest arm of Nanquib heads below Brady Peak and between Brady Peak and Tridal Peak. So,
okay,
a pretty remote area,
yeah,
that neither of us had been into, and we decided to check it out, right? So we knew we were going to be gone for a long day. But there were some springs shown in the upper part of Nanquib in this drainage, so we were thinking maybe we could get some water there, but it wasn't critical because we carried enough for the day when we left our camp. And so we had a long hike to get up the southwest arm of Nanquib.
Okay.
And the first place we went was, well, we got to the very end of the drainage. It splits into two, and one drainage goes due west up towards Vista Encantada, just south of Brady Peak. The other drainage goes to the southwest, and that heads up to the on the north side of Tridal Peak. So Art decided he wanted to kind of just hang out at this junction point between the two drainages, and I thought, well, okay, I'm going to head up this west drainage then and see what I can find up here. And so I was heading up. I took off up that, and it very quickly steepens, and there's a lot of down timber in there.
Oh.
Huge ponderosa pines that have fallen across the creek and clogged it, and there are debris dams where there's a pine or a number of pines that have fallen and lodged in the creek bottom, and then all this debris flow material, sandstone and boulders, has piled up behind it, right, forming little ponds.
Wow.
So this, you can see, it's kind of interesting because this was an example of another, an older debris flow deposit, right, or probably a number of debris flows that had come
right
down this particular drainage in the past decades. And it was kind of a nice contrast with the one we'd seen in Quaggan a few days before, which was brand new, but it made the going really slow. There was all sorts of the burned wood in there, and so some of that must have come down off of burns on the rim.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Yeah, and we're still down below the red wall, right? And
wow.
So it was quite impressive to see all this detritus but it was slow going, but I did get up to where I could see that I wasn't going to get through the red wall.
Okay.
And so at that point, with the slow going, if the walking is nice, I love to get into these amphitheaters beneath these red wall pour-offs, right?
Mm.
Because it's like being in a big cathedral,
right?
A red with red light everywhere, those experiences are only happen when the walking to get up into the cathedral is relatively straightforward, and this was not at all.
Mm.
And so I turned around and went back down and found Art. I got a great picture of him sleeping on a gravel bar, just with his head just down on the rocks, And so anyways, we chatted for a few minutes, and I decided, well, look, I want to go up this other arm. We got the time here. Let's check it out. And he said, okay, go ahead. I'll wait for you here. So I headed up the arm that heads up towards on the north side of Tridal Peak. And this one wasn't, it didn't climb as steeply, and it didn't have nearly the vegetation in it. I guess when I say vegetation, I mean the down vegetation,
right?
The deadfall that was in the other drainage. And still a lot of vegetation not growing there, and so it's you have to push through the willows and tamarisk and whatnot, but a little bit of flow here and there. It was really kind of just one of these angelic little places. And so I went up again as far as I could. I could, you know, just ahead I could see that it was going to be cliffing out and and not able to go much any farther. So I turned around and met Art, and then and at that point then we relaxed, because even in April it was it's kind of warm in the sun. So we took a good break there, you know, half an hour or so, and then headed back down to our camp way down at, you know, in Lower Nankoweap. So a really nice day of exploration there. So finally then on the last day, we the plan was just to head out the Nankoweap Trail. And so we started up the trail, and it's pretty uneventful, but our timing was, you know, really, we were really on. And I had mentioned on the previous hike when we came up the Nankoweap that, you know, we were disappointed with how slow we were going and how we felt, how tired we felt.
Right.
And when we got back after our trip, we checked the times of our previous hikes, and we found that we weren't really that much slower than we had been. It's just that we felt more tired. Well, this trip was you know, better in that we actually felt great, and we did the hike in much faster time. So it was pretty neat to accomplish that. But there was one interesting experience here, and it was kind of near the top of the Red Wall. And I remember, you know, there's some nice switchbacks that are preserved there, and in the upper part of the Red Wall. The lower part of the Red Wall has all been slid out. The original trail work is all missing, and the Park Service has done a pretty good job of trying to reestablish a trail there.
Mm-hmm.
But the original trail work's missing, and you can see on the upper part of the Red Wall, you know, the original track, and there's a couple of cribs where you know, the trail has been built up past a little cavity or a cliff around a spot in a cliff and whatnot. So it's pretty neat to see all this, because it presumably dates from the time of Powell, right? And when Powell put the trail in, but just before we got to the summit, there's this long switchback up through the Red Wall, and you know, you can proceed up it pretty quickly. And and as we're going up, I could see there was somebody coming down. I thought, well, this is interesting. We're going to meet a person on the trail, and so I met the person first. It turns out it's a National Park Service ranger.
Okay.
And so, you know, we started chatting, and then I said, no, I've got a partner. He's coming up the trail. You know, you can see him right just a few little ways down. And we chatted about, you know, what we'd been doing. And so when Art joined me, the ranger, and I think her name was, let's see, Chrissy Morb, Moerbe, I believe. That's what I have in my notes, anyways. Christy Morb, and very, very pleasant.
Mm-hmm.
And when Art came up, we continued the discussion, and then she said, well, can I see you guys' permit? And unfortunately, this is one of the trips when we had neglected to get a permit. So we told Ranger Morby that we didn't have a permit, and she said, well, you know, I'm going to have to cite you guys.
Mm-hmm.
And write it up, and when you get back to town, you know, it'd be nice if you could pay the fee for your permit.
Mm-hmm.
and get it established that way. And we agreed, of course we're going to do that, right?
Yeah.
You know, nobody wants to be contrary here on purpose. So yeah, so Art gave her, you know, his identification so that she could write him. Now, I don't know, I don't remember now why, you know, the responsibility fell on Art, and whether he volunteered his identification first or because he's the fellow in Arizona, I don't know that, but I do know that they never, you know, she never took my identification, just took Art's.
Oh, okay.
But you know, it's one of those experiences where, well, we've had our trips, and it was inevitable that we would get caught, I guess, and you know, you're going to do what you have to do to make things right. And mm-hmm. so what happened in, you know, subsequently is that Art got back. We both got back home, and Art got a letter from the Park Service. Well, actually, he independently, as soon as he got home, he contacted the Backcountry Ranger office and paid for the permit, right? And so I don't know how much it cost, but you know, it would have been 8 days per person plus the permit fee, etc. Mm-hmm. And then he subsequently got a letter a few weeks later from another ranger, and basically saying, you know, thank you for paying your permit fee, and we appreciate you sharing your knowledge of hiking, etc. And you know, we had mentioned, Art had mentioned that he'd been hiking in the Grand Canyon for more than 50 years, right?
Right.
And so this was all mentioned in the permit, and then the fellow said, you know, please in future register for permits for your hikes. Otherwise, it could be serious, you know.
Uh-huh.
So
that sounds nice. It's like, okay, this is a warning. You know, you need a permit. And, you know, you guys have been doing this a long time, and we respect that, but heads up.
Yeah, fair enough. And so, yeah, it was a nice, Art sent me a copy of the letter for my files, and it, you know, it's very nicely written. I think it's very respectful, and
nice.
I concur with it, you know, completely, so with the philosophy there. So, you know, we'll do the best we can to get permits going forward, right? So it was an interesting, you know, experience at the age of, what was this? I would have been 60. I guess I was 64 or something like that. Because I, you know, when I was many, many years ago, I think I told you about one of our early hikes on the South Rim with my friend Chris, and we got caught in, I think it was Hot Cottonwood Creek.
Right.
When a search party who was looking for a hiker who'd gone missing on the Tanner Trail dropped a helicopter into our campsite because they
right.
could see our tent.
Right.
And they wanted to know if we'd seen this fellow, and we hadn't, of course. And they asked us for our permit. We had a permit. And we were supposed to be in Clear Creek, right? And here we were
quite a ways away.
Cottonwood.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, at that point, the ranger was very cool. He just said, "Look, boys, get back on your permit." You
yeah.
know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's kind of like bookending my hiking career. You know, that experience early on, and then this latter experience with Art.
Right.
In later years, excuse me. And each time, I have to say, you know, the rangers have been extremely polite, and,
right.
and the follow-up was, in this latter case, was, you know, very, very respectful. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, I try to be respectful of that myself. So,
it does beg the question, though, because what is the difference between an itinerary with... How to put this question carefully. Without a permit in wilderness, you walk, you go here, you go there, you have an agenda, and you may not make that agenda. You've got a pretty full agenda, things you want to do. There's a big list of things. Then you go out and you start walking around to see what you can do. With a permit, you have to be in a certain use area for a certain day, and you know, people work really hard to be on itinerary, which is good if you get hurt. People need to find you, you know, where were they? Where are they supposed to be? But it's a different journey. Now, I'm not saying what you did. I'm not condoning what you've done. I'm just saying, you know, what is the difference between following that pre-prescribed itinerary, you know, we've got to today, we need to be here, and today we need to be there, and now we're behind, now we got to work harder, versus we got a list of things we'd like to do, let's see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
Can you speak to that?
Yeah, I could try to. You know, again, I'm giving you my personal thoughts.
Yeah.
And philosophy, and not everybody would subscribe to this, and I can understand that, you know. But I think you kind of touched on it there initially. I see three main reasons why these permit systems have been implemented. Number one, for safety purposes, right? And you mentioned that. Number two, to minimize the human impact in some of these areas.
Of course.
Okay. And then number three, to maximize the aesthetic values,
yes,
that hikers get when they go into these areas.
Right.
And so, you know, and so for those reasons, they limit the number of people who can go into areas. And, you know, you're all supposed to follow the outline that you have identified you're going to take.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and that's great if you have a hike in mind, which is like a through hike to, you know, to go through certain use areas. I don't know if the listeners are going to know what these use areas are.
Right.
But, you know, they're geographically defined regions where only a number of people are allowed in on any particular day.
Correct.
And the use areas in the proximity to the corridor trails, the use areas are very small because then most of the people are utilizing, you know, the corridor trails, and so they're trying to minimize the number of people in these relatively small spaces.
Right.
Or maximize the distribution, let's put it that way.
Right. And you say, to maximize the aesthetics. So, you know, the concept is you will not run into another group.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody who's coming in without a permit has the chance of running into somebody who has a permit, and that starts tearing into the concept of wilderness. I'm not going to see anybody else when I'm down here.
Yeah, yeah. But in many parts of the canyon, for instance, in this area of Eastern Grand Canyon, where we've been hanging out for the last few years, you know, these use areas are very large.
Mm.
And so if you're in Nanqueep Creek, you've come down the trail, yeah, it's likely if you're camping at the bottom of the Nanqueep Trail at Nanqueep Creek,
right,
you're going to see other people because that's a popular area. It's like a corridor,
right?
Right.
Right.
But if you go into Upper Nanqueep, I have never encountered anybody in these upper arms of Nanqueep hiking, day hiking, or overnight hiking. The only time I would say I did was when I was climbing Burke Point in Nanqueep, and I could look across the valley, and this was in the 70s, mid-70s, I could look across the valley, and I could see climbers on Ehrenberg Point, and that was Jim Ullman's party.
Okay,
right? We just happened to be in the canyon on the same time, and I could hear them, you know, yelling en belay, and
yeah, uh-huh.
I could see them in my binoculars, but again, this is another climbing party, right? And that's the only time I've ever encountered anybody in these very remote backwoods settings. And so the fact that, you know, this use area encompasses, let's say it encompasses the entire Quaggan drainage, you know, you're precluding people from going up into Upper Quaggan, which can be a day just to get up in there, simply because there's a number of people hanging out down in Lower Quaggan.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And so I understand, you know, you've got to draw the boundaries somewhere, and you've got to have a rationale. But what it precludes is being able to go into these areas and spend time kind of exploring, as we have been wont to do. I mean, that I think our discussions have been peppered with instances where we didn't make what we tried to do.
Exactly.
You know? And we had to turn around. I mean,
yep.
If we had a permit to go from Quaggan into Char, well, then, and then farther along, right, into say, Basalt or Unkar, well, we would have had to We had to turn around. We would have had to go in to get back on our permit. We would have had to go a completely different way, and we would have had to violate other use areas,
right,
just to try and stay on our permit. And I guess other people would say, well, you should turn around and go home at that point, right?
Well, but, no. The question I have is how could the backcountry be managed? Now, clearly, there's a number of different management things you're trying to protect for. You don't want too many people in an area. You don't want them bumping into each other. But at the same time, how can you manage for this type of creative journey where I'm not exactly sure where we're going to go, I'm not exactly sure what we're going to see or how we're going to see it, but that's the general area we want to go in.
Yeah, yeah.
And how would one build a permit system that allowed that type of creativity?
Yeah, I think I don't have a ready answer to this. You'd think after the decades I've been thinking about it that there would be an obvious solution, but there isn't, and that's why the whole process is very complex, mm-hmm. right, and unsatisfying. But I think that, you know, with adequate knowledge of hiking destinations and opportunities in the Grand Canyon, in other words, somebody who knows where people like to go or would want to go, you can kind of split these areas up into smaller segments. And, you know, I'm not saying that you split it up into smaller segments and then you still dictate that, you know, only X number of people are going to be in each little tiny use area. But you can, I think, at that point say, okay, well, you know, we got this party, Haggard and Christensen, that want to go explore in Upper Nanqui for 4 days. And so we can isolate them from people who are down by the river. You know
right.
what I mean?
Right.
And who are just hanging out on the Nanqueep Trail. Because
right.
most hikers, even in the backcountry, I think, are still restricting themselves to the trails, you know?
Right.
Whether they're not maintained or non-maintained. Nowadays, they're essentially maintained in some way. They're maintained by hikers, right?
Right.
But still, most people are limiting themselves to those corridors, and if you're going cross country, that is when you tend to get away from the crowds. So if you can stipulate in the permitting process what type of hiking and where in each use area the party wants to go, I think it would provide more options. And if you could say, well, we want to do cross-country hiking in exploration-type hiking in the upper arms of Nanqueep,
mm-hmm.
For 3 days, we probably have a base camp at, you know, this spot, and we, you know, would do our best to avoid contact with other people because
right.
we don't really want to, you know, intrude on other people's camps or anything
right.
like that.
Right.
And sometimes you run across people, and it's always fun to talk to people, right, that are down there. But it still raises the question of what happens when you have an objective and you have to turn around, right?
Right.
And again, you know, my point would be that in these extended hikes, when we're off trail, we very, very rarely have run into people. And so, putting together a permit, I think, to say, yeah, Art and Jim, we would like to go down into Nanqueep and Quaggan and try and get into Char Creek, but, you know, and to do these objectives. But if something happens, you know, we would probably go into Upper Nanqueep and explore these arms, something like that, right? Just so that there would be an understanding that, yeah, we're in this area, people are using this area, and that's another reason, I guess, that they want to keep track of this information, is they want to see, you know, keep track of how many people are using these areas
right.
and impacting them. And
yeah.
so I'd be happy with providing that information as long as it wasn't used to say, no, you can't go in there at all.
Right.
You know
well,
what I mean?
It's funny. So there's a use area, and the majority of the people in that use area go down the trail to the creek bed, down the creek bed to the river. Maybe they go over to Quaggan, over the saddle, between Neckwheat Mesa and Neckwheat Butte. And so, there, like you say, there are these general routes that people follow. And then there are the routes that are not general, that the, in quotes, average backpacker in Grand Canyon will not follow. And so what is the resource manager to do? You really don't want these people bumping into each other, even on the main trail where you got to get down to the creek bed, and then you know, some folks are going to go down to the river, and some folks are going to go up and explore, mm-hmm. you know, the red wall in Upper Nanko, which is a huge area. How do you regulate that as a manager?
Yeah.
And so I can appreciate the park says, we don't care where you go or what you want to do. We're only going to let, you know, two small groups or one large group in there every night, that period. That's it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and that, I guess that, you know, that philosophy then defeats the option of a small party going in and exploring a totally different area of the drainage. So
well, it doesn't. What I'm just kind of trying to play devil's advocate. I think what the manager would say is, wait a minute, we don't. You know, a small group could go in there and go down the trail and hang a right and go up the drainage and just mess around in there for days and days. We wouldn't care, but they need a permit.
Oh well, that's okay. I mean, if that's the system, I concur completely with that. I didn't understand what you were suggesting
there. Yeah.
And I feel like that's the way to deal with it. I mean, you can point to any area, like, you know, look at Clear Creek. You've got these huge drainages of Crystal. I'm sorry, I was thinking of the Crystal Creek drainage. You've got the huge Crystal Creek drainage, and then you've got the Dragon Creek drainage. Each of those are mammoth.
Yeah.
There's so much exploration that can be done in there, you know. And if you're just letting a few people go in there who have come down from Teal Point, you know, and are hanging out in Crystal, you know, why not just let a small party go up and explore the upper arms where nobody's going to, you know, ever really goes, very rarely goes.
Right.
I think if that flexibility was allowed, that would be much, much more valuable.
Yeah.
Because, you know, nobody, I think most people want to do the right thing. And it's not like I didn't get permits because I was just trying to, you know, spit in the face of the Park Service.
Exactly.
It was because in the early days, it was just so inconvenient, you know. You had to go to that backcountry office, even if you're on the south rim, even if you're going to go down the Nanquib Trail.
Right, right.
And you know, you had to, and then of course, you know, they implemented the day use areas, and then it's like, well, we want to go into Vishnu, but we can't get through Clear Creek, you know, because that area is used. It's filled up, and so you can't go to Vishnu because Clear Creek is subscribed. And so, you know, things like that just got to be kind of overwhelming, and it caused a lot of frustration and just reluctance.
Mm.
But I think what you're describing, this idea where, you know, people who want to move away from the corridor trails or not even use them at all, you know, when I say corridor trails, I mean, in, you know, the existing trail network.
Right.
People in
the backcountry, not the south rim to north rim Phantom Ranch corridor, but you know, outside of there, in the backcountry.
Even in there, say the Nanquib Trail. I mean, I consider that to be somewhat of a corridor.
Absolutely,
because,
you bet.
You know, you see people camped along that trail.
Yes.
You know, people camp on the top of the Red Wall.
Yep.
I did that once with my uncle, and split it up into 2 days. But that's kind of a core. It's an access trail into Nanquib drainage.
Right.
It'd be
like the Tanner Trail, or
sure.
You know, any of the other the North Bass Trail, the South Bass Trail. These historic walkways that lead to huge country with lots of options. So,
mm-hmm.
So how would you put together? Well, it'd be curious, you know. Just think about this in the next months or so. You know, how would you put together a permit system that allowed for that type of creative wandering?
Yeah, okay. All right, I'm happy to think about that for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, this is great discussion. And if it resulted in a new system that encouraged people to sign up for permits and didn't discourage them from doing so, because of restrictions, then I think it's going to benefit everybody.
Right. And
our service is going
because what you're doing, what you and Art and Bruce have been doing is a real wonderful vision into an area without an itinerary, if you will. Yeah, you got an idea. You'd like to do this, but if that doesn't happen, you're going to do something else. And I guess you could argue, well, everybody's doing that, but oftentimes it's like, no, the permit system drives what you do instead of the place driving what you do.
Mm-hmm.
And so how would you put a permit system together that honored the place and allowed for that kind of creative wandering? I don't know.
It's challenging, but I think there's some variation on what you described earlier, where you have the creative wandering option for this particular drainage, this basin.
Yeah.
So you're going to stay away from the Nankweep Trail, right? And the high use areas, and we're going to be walking around in the remote area where very few people ever go, and.
Right.
And we don't know exactly where we're going to go and when and, whatnot, but it will all work out for the best, and we can give you a detailed report when we get back.
Exactly.
If that's useful.
The general plan is we're going that away.
Yeah.
We just don't know how we're actually going to do this, but that's the plan. And could that be accommodated in a permit system? I think it'd be lovely if it could.
I think it could, but again, it requires somebody who's managing the permit system who has a pretty good understanding of the hiking options,
And I think that the current cadre of people in the permits office, they've got that. They're pretty savvy about, and if they haven't been in the area, they'll know they haven't been in the area, but they'll know that it exists,
mm-hmm.
and that there's potential to do this sort of stuff there. So,
For sure. Yeah. And they've got Harvey's map and probably a lot of other hikers. Maps who that I'd be happy to send them my map and show them all the places that people can go, right?
And so
you get an idea. Well, yeah, there's a lot of opportunities to spend in Upper Nankweep or Quaggan,
right.
and so
Clear Creek or the Dragon or points further west.
Well, I'm happy to talk more about it, and maybe. Maybe there's a workshop with the Park Service in the cards.
I'd be interested to hear your. Maybe we'll talk about this before we complete this series. If you've got some ideas about it, it'd be interesting to get it on tape, and that would be fun. Cool.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll continue to ponder it. We can chat about it again for sure.
That sounds good. Anything else about this hike that you want to besides running into? Ranger Morby.
I think that was pretty much it. That was the end of it,
Okay.
And from there it was just a quick. Should say, I said quick, but it was quicker than usual, right?
Mm.
Up to the saddle and then back to the vehicle. So,
yeah.
Okay. Just another great trip with my friend Art.
Cool. Wonderful. Well, with that, let's go ahead and conclude part 31. Of a Grand Canyon Oral History with Jim Haggart. Today is Sunday, May 22nd, 2022. My name is Tom Martin, and Jim, thank you so very, very much.
Well, thanks for the opportunity, Tom. Really appreciate it.